The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Imperialist Rivalry and War. As the Earth became completely carved up into spheres of influence between the great powers, competition between them intensified. A balance of power was maintained by each state arming itself to the teeth. But the balance was continually in danger of being upset by the emergence of a new power eager for a slice of the imperial pie. Lenin, writing at the time of the First World War, described this new period of capitalism as imperialism. In a nutshell, capitalism in its monopoly stage, the world market dominated by giant capitalist trusts, backed up by powerful states fighting to carve up the world amongst themselves. He called monopoly capitalism the economic essence of imperialism, noting its main features as monopolies, oligarchy, the striving for domination and not for freedom, the exploitation of an increasing number of small or weak nations by a handful of the richest or most powerful nations. End quote. Lenin's analysis, written in 1916 in the midst of the slaughter of the First World War, pointed to the fact that imperialism was not a policy, but a new stage in the development of capitalism that grew out of earlier conditions. Just as free competition gave way to monopoly, so free trade gave way to trade wars and armed conflict. The logic of imperialism was grounded in international economic competition between states, leading to war. There were people at the time, like German socialist Karl Kautsky, who argued that the creation of a world market and economic interdependence between nations would make war obsolete, creating a new system of, quote, ultra-imperialism. Unfortunately, the fact that there is economic interdependence does not lead to peaceful relations between states, much less their disappearance. Two tendencies always have to be kept in mind, as Lenin noted, in capitalism's development. On the one hand, the awakening of national life and the creation of nation-states, and on the other hand, the development and growing frequency of international intercourse and the breakdown of national barriers. These two contradictory tendencies, towards interdependence on the one hand, and toward consolidation of national states on the other, have been constant features of capitalism throughout its history. The balance between the two tendencies and the way the contradiction has expressed itself has shifted. But the contradiction remains, even today, at the heart of world capitalism. In addition to its role in maintaining class rule, capitalists needed a centralized state as a means of creating a single, unified market that could facilitate commerce. But the state is also crucial in providing necessary infrastructure, and sometimes the pooling of capitalist resources needed for national capitalists to operate and compete effectively. As capitalism burst the bounds of the nation-state, the coercive military function of the state took on a new dimension, that of protecting and projecting the interests of the capitalists of one country over those of another. The role of the state increased, and the size of the state bureaucracy increased, and the size of its coercive apparatus increased. The development of world capitalism leads, wrote Russian revolutionary Nikolai Bukharin, quote, on the one hand, to an internationalization of economic life, and, on the other, to the leveling of economic differences, and, to an infinitely greater degree, The same process of economic development intensifies the tendency to nationalize capitalist interests, to form narrow national groups armed to the teeth and ready to hurl themselves at one another at any moment. End quote. It is true that, as Trotsky wrote during the First World War, the natural tendency of our economic system is to seek to break through the state boundaries. The whole globe, the land and the sea, the surface as well as the interior, has become one economic workshop, the different parts of which are inseparably connected with each other. End quote. But this process, rather than leading to peaceful competition, leads to a struggle for dominance. Quote, the way the governments propose to solve this problem of imperialism is not through the intelligent, organized cooperation of all humanity's producers, but through the exploitation of the world's economic system by the capitalist class of the victorious country. Which country is by this war to be transformed from a great power into a world power? End quote. Two devastating world wars that consumed millions of lives underscored the truth of Trotsky's observation. The whole history of the world conflict up to the present day consists of the continual rejigging of power relations between a handful of states and their allies. The economic relations between different states continually change, i.e., think of the recent rise of China and India, compelling new trade and diplomatic intrigues as upstarts try to assert their power and the established powers try to hang on or expand what power they have. Ultimately, force decides who is to be top dog. But since the economic balance of forces keeps changing, new conflicts always emerge and the game begins anew. Today, we no longer have a world divided between many contending colonial powers, as in the early 20th century. A series of anti-colonial movements and revolutions, combined with the declining economic value of the colonies, put an end to this era in the years following the Second World War. The United States emerged as the world's dominant power, both economically and militarily. Instead of a world divided between several centers of world power, imperial rivalry took the form of a Cold War between two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. Each had enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world several times over, in a balance of terror appropriately called MAD, mutually assured destruction. Much of the conflict of the Cold War took the form of not of direct military conflict between Russia and the United States, but of smaller conflicts on the system's periphery, such as the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Russia was never economically strong enough to challenge U.S. hegemony over major parts of the globe. Ideologically, though, the United States used the Russian threat as an excuse for whatever interventions it undertook, such as when it destabilized and overthrew nationalist regimes it opposed. Fighting communism was used as the excuse to overthrow the Mossadegh government in Iran in 1953, the Arbenz government in Guatemala in 1954, the Allende government in Chile in 1973, and many others. The end of the Cold War did not mean the end of imperialism or military conflict, but it has changed the playing field. The United States emerged as the sole superpower, more than twice the size of its nearest economic rival and several times bigger militarily. The United States alone accounts for half the world's military spending. It is the only state with a truly global military outreach, boasting 725 military bases around the globe, not including the United States. The logic of imperialist rivalry compels America's rulers to continually demonstrate and reinforce this dominance, lest its relative position in the world pecking order slips or any potential challengers detect any weakening. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States cast around for a new rationale for its role as global hegemon. It found it in the War on Terror. The Bush administration saw in the September 11, 2001, tragedy, a unique window of opportunity, a modern day Pearl Harbor, that created ideal conditions for advancing its agenda. Some months after September 11th, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice described the attacks as an enormous opportunity, and that the United States, quote, must move to take advantage of these new opportunities, end quote. The invasion of Afghanistan was first and foremost a warm-up for the invasion of Iraq, and was secondarily about establishing a strategic military presence in Central Asia. Overthrowing the Taliban and going after Al-Qaeda was merely a pretext. Likewise, the invasion and occupation of Iraq had nothing to do with the character of the Iraqi regime. The United States has always supported friendly dictators, and will continue to do so. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the extremely accurate pre-invasion prediction of Jay Bookman of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, was, quote, not really about Iraq. It is not about weapons of mass destruction, or terrorism, or Saddam, or UN resolutions. Rather, the war was intended to mark the official emergence of the United States as a full-fledged global empire, seizing sole responsibility and authority as planetary policemen. They never had an exit strategy, argued Bookman, not out of incompetence, but because the United States was interested in creating permanent military bases in that country from which to dominate the Middle East, including neighboring Iran. End quote. It is tempting to see the movement of American imperialism into overdrive after September 11th as the product of temporary insanity. Some of the pronouncements of the Bush administration would have come off as almost Monty Python-esque if it weren't for the terrible bloodletting they justified. The generals in Iraq must understand clearly there will be consequences for their behavior, Bush smugly warned on the eve of the U.S. invasion. Quote, should they choose to behave in a way that endangers the lives of their own citizens, as well as citizens in the neighborhood, there will be a consequence. They will be held to account. End quote. In reading this, I was reminded of the Requerimiento, an official document 16th century conquistadors were meant to read out loud to their victims, in Spanish, a language those about to be attacked could not understand, before they slaughtered them. The document insisted that its listeners accept the church and the Spanish crown, warning, quote, but if you do not do this, and maliciously make delay in it, we shall powerfully enter into your country, and shall make war against you in all ways and manners that we can, and shall subject you to the yoke and obedience of the church and of their highnesses. We shall take you and your wives and your children, and shall make slaves of them, and as such shall sell and dispose of them as their highnesses may command. And we shall take away your goods, and shall do you all the mischief and damage that we can, as to vassals who do not obey. and we protest that the deaths and losses which shall accrue from this are your fault, and not the fault of their highnesses, or ours, nor of these cavaliers who have come with us." End quote. The text may be arcane, but its twisted logic strikes me as utterly modern. Obey the United States, and if you refuse, you will be to blame for the destruction we visit on you. Only now a twist is added. Since we are here to give you, quote, freedom, you have no reason to resist. "We're here to give you your fucking freedom," a U.S. Marine shouted at a crowd of Iraqis protesting the occupation of Baghdad. Quote, "Now back off." The insanity thesis ignores the essential continuity in U.S. foreign policy. The disagreements between different administrations and parties in Washington have not been over whether the United States should militarily and economically dominate the world, but how, unilaterally or with subordinate allies. But how? Democrat Bill Clinton, it should be recalled, ratcheted up the military budget by $112 billion, rehabilitated Reagan's Star Wars missile defense program, and sent troops into other countries more times than all four previous presidents combined. He enforced sanctions against Iraq that resulted in 1 million deaths. Indeed, the Clinton administration made the case for intervening in, quote, failed states to impose, quote, regime change, setting the table for what was to come. Three of the chief goals of U.S. imperialism today, according to Chalmers Johnson, are to, quote, maintain absolute military preponderance over the rest of the world, a task that includes imperial policing to ensure that no part of the empire slips the leash, attempting to control as many sources of petroleum as possible, both to service America's insatiable demand for fossil fuels, and to use it as a bargaining chip with even more oil-dependent regions, and providing work and income for the military-industrial complex, as, for example, in the exorbitant profits Halliburton has extracted for building and operating camps Bondsteel and Monteith. End quote. This comprehensive framework has the advantage of explaining not only why the United States has invaded Iraq, oil, but why it meddles in Africa, Asia, and every other corner of the globe. The United States has been an imperialist power now for more than a century, cloaking its predatory aims with claims to be spreading democracy, removing tyrants, fighting communism, bringing humanitarian help, and now defending the homeland against terrorism. The most significant innovation after September the 11th was the brazenness with which the pundits proclaimed America's God-given right to police the world. It is now fashionable to accept that the United States is an empire that has the right and duty to be, in the words of international relations professor and former Army Colonel Andrew Bacevich, quote, "the world's sole military superpower until the end of time." End of quote. That does not mean that everything has gone Washington's way. The defeat in Vietnam was a clear reminder that the beast is not invulnerable. The way in which the occupation of Iraq, which was meant to be a cakewalk, turned into a quagmire, thanks primarily to the stiff resistance Iraqis put up to the destruction of their country, is another reminder. And though the United States will for years continue to be the top dog, its relative economic and military power is bound to decline. End of section.